This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News, joined as I am every episode of The Takeout by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, Steve Shigaris, Political Director of CBS News. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Major.
And a happy good morning to everyone. We're having breakfast at Cafe Deluxe right near the CBS News Bureau in downtown Washington, D.C. First time here at Cafe Deluxe. Those are the happy sounds you hear around us. Rupert, our excellent waiter, will be by in a minute. We'll order breakfast and get on with the meal portion of the Takeout podcast, because every episode of this show is built around a meal and a conversation. Now, those of you who are brand new to this show, sometimes we immerse ourselves in the news of the week. Sometimes we take a step back. This week, we are deep in the roiling waters of the news cycle. And we have two phenomenal guests. Our first husband and wife duo on The Takeout, John Wood and his wife, Julie Myers Wood, both exceptionally qualified to talk about the news of the week, which is the indictments of Paul Manafort and Rick Gates and the plea agreement of George Papadopoulos, both, all three of them associated with the Trump campaign at one level or another. And also the terrorist attack in New York and some of the immigration and legal questions that have arisen from that. A huge week of news, so much to unpack, and we could not be more delighted to have John and Julie with us. Good morning, John. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning. Hey, good morning.
Thanks for having us on.
So I want to jump right into something the president said, because both of you have experience in the federal system of law. John was a U.S. attorney in the Western District of Missouri for a good long while. Julie was a former head of Immigration, Customs, and Enforcement at the Department of Homeland Security, served as Deputy Assistant Secretary, overseeing money laundering and financial crimes at the Treasury Department. So your experience in this world is very large. I want to run something that the president said yesterday in the cabinet room about federal prosecutors.
Wednesday.
Thank you, Steve. Wednesday, earlier this week. About federal prosecutions of terrorism suspects. That's clip number one. Let's listen.
We also have to come up with punishment that's far quicker and far greater than the punishment these animals are getting right now. They'll go through court for years. At the end, they'll be who knows what happens. We need quick justice, and we need strong justice, much quicker and much stronger than we have right now. Because what we have right now is a joke, and it's a laughingstock.
John, a joke? Laughingstock?
Well, there are a lot of things in there to unpack, but one thing that sort of stood out is that the president said that we need to have swift punishment. But I don't think that the urgency is really so much with regard to the punishment. I think where the urgency comes in is if this defendant has actionable intelligence, the urgency is trying to get that intelligence. And I think that some of the tension that we face in our judicial system, which is largely unchanged over the past 200 years, there's tension between a lot of the bedrock principles of our judicial system of protecting defendants' rights, due process, et cetera, and some of the needs such as gathering intelligence in this asymmetrical war on terror that we're fighting right now. And so I think those are some of the challenges. But I don't think that the president was right when he said we need swift punishment. And so I think when he describes our judicial system as a joke, I very much disagree with that. I think our judicial system works very well. But as I said, there are tensions between our traditional judicial system, which has changed so little over the years, and this new kind of war that we've been facing since 9/11.
And Julie, I was in the cabinet room with the president, and I asked him, do you want to or would you consider sending this particular suspect from the New York attack to Guantanamo Base? And I'll consider it. I consider, well, that's off the table now. But from your perspective, I think most in the federal judicial prosecuting world would say, well, Guantanamo is a place where people are housed, but they're not really successfully prosecuted. And the federal system has successfully prosecuted a great number of not only suspects, but in complex cases.
That's exactly right. Both the Southern District of New York and the Eastern District of New York, I was proud to serve as an AUSA, have brought some very significant...
Assistant U.S. Attorney, right?
Assistant U.S. Attorney.
We always try to unpack the nomenclature of Washington, D.C. for our listeners across the country.
Acronyms are forbidden.
That's right. Uh-oh. That's as a longtime government employee, that'll be tough. But I think it's important to note that just this morning there were charges filed. And so, you know, the justice system has been swift in moving forward with charges, but I would agree with John that I think what is critical is to try to see if we can get the right kind of intelligence and to try to understand, you know, what he will say, if anything, try to talk to his wife, his neighbors. You know, if he became radicalized over the last few years, someone noticed, someone saw what was going on, and we need to really understand that and then, frankly, reverse engineer it so we can try to prevent those things from happening in the future.
I just would like to get you guys to weigh in on something. The president clearly is trying to sound tough on terrorism or tough. This is the first real sort of homeland issues had to deal with in terms of terror. But he doesn't have the understanding, it seems, of how government works, how the legal system works. He doesn't have that experience as a businessman coming into this. How does that make you feel as people who have worked as attorneys in the government, but also as attorneys in general, about what he says in such stark terms, really for political reasons?
Or does it rattle you to hear those kind of words?
Well, I think having an outside perspective of somebody who has not served in government can be valuable, but obviously I wish that he would think a little bit more and vet a little bit more some of his comments, because some of the comments that he made could have a real impact when it comes time to actually try this defendant. So, you know, the comments that he made about saying that the death penalty is appropriate, that has the potential to taint the jury pool. So he could actually be creating challenges for the prosecution by saying some of those things. So I do wish that he had vetted those a little bit more with the Justice Department and the lawyers at the White House Counsel's office before he said it publicly.
But I think it's fair to say everybody is frustrated with the justice system. You know, we all wish it would work faster, that we had better intelligence ahead of time. And so I think it's understandable that he has frustration. I think the choice of words here was, you know, quite unfortunate. As John notes, you know, some of the things he said could have a prejudicial effect when picking a jury or otherwise.
And let's talk briefly about this question that I also raised at one of the White House briefings this week about enemy combatant. And the White House, through Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, said they considered this suspect in New York an enemy combatant. Would that have made a difference? That's not his treatment now. He's going to be treated prosecuted through the federal judicial system, not an enemy combatant. But either one of you, John or Julie, tell our listeners what that would have meant and how that might have or might not have changed the ability to interrogate successfully the suspect.
Yeah, well, basically, as I understand it, treating him as an enemy combatant would mean that he'd be taken out of the judicial system and be put through a military justice system where some of the rights are different. So, for example, the traditional Miranda rights that people are familiar with from watching television, you know, you have the right to remain silent and things like that.
Access to an attorney,
some of those don't necessarily apply if you're treated as an enemy combatant. And so that's why, you know, people who are captured on the battlefield in Afghanistan aren't given all those same rights to an attorney before the U.S. government can question them and try and get information. Whereas, you know, in the traditional judicial system in the U.S., if you're not given your Miranda rights and you make a statement that's incriminating, that can't be used against you in court.
And Julie, does it make any difference, or would it have made any difference, that he is a permanent legal resident, the suspect in New York?
You know, not really for that, you know, classification, although certainly there would be legal challenges if they tried to take him. I'm sure there would be court challenges right away.
There wasn't the Jose Padilla case.
That's exactly
the
right.
One American citizen who was held as a material witness for a while by the Justice Department under President George W. Bush, then classified as an enemy combatant, not sent to Guantanamo, but sent to a military brig in South Carolina. That never went anywhere. Ultimately, he was prosecuted by
the
federal justice system. Exactly.
That's right. But
is that instructive, do you think, that experience, that process that we learned, that the Bush Justice Department went through and learned from?
Absolutely. I think there are a lot of lessons from things that worked well and from things that were challenged successfully that didn't work well. And I think the end game, as John noted, is really getting the intelligence. And so they have to think about, you know, how can we move forward with this individual to get the best chance of getting some intelligence from him, if in any way possible. And I think bringing those charges this morning and trying to work through that system really makes a lot of sense here.
And that process of intelligence, also learning about who his associates were, if any, and how does the radicalization process begin? Does it gain momentum? And are there any people who were involved to either expedite or accelerate that process? All questions that are trying to be asked and answered.
That's exactly right. I mean, we understand that he has been interviewed in the past by FBI or Homeland Security officials with respect to his relationships to some other individuals from Uzbekistan. And so, you know, what did they know at that time? What were they thinking about? And, you know, looking back now, should they have connected the dots in a different way? I think those are questions that everyone needs to be asking.
And we'll ask and try to answer them on a continuous basis here at the Takeout Podcast. I'm Major Garrett with Steve Shigaris. We'll be back in just a second.
You're listening to The Takeout.
A big hello to all of our viewers on CBSN, all of our radio listeners across the country, and those of you enjoying this episode of The Takeout in podcast land. Welcome one and all. I'm Major Garrett, joined as I am every episode by Steve Shigaris, the world's greatest podcast sidekick. Hello and good morning,
hello,
Steve.
Hello again.
We're at Cafe Deluxe. Rupert, our outstanding waiter, is here to take our breakfast order. So, Rupert, approach the table. John, what would you like for breakfast?
I will go with the blueberry pancakes and an orange juice, please.
There we go. Julie.
I'll have two scrambled eggs and some Tabasco, please.
Very
Lots
good.
Of Tabasco.
Spicy.
For the table, Rupert, we will have the iron skillet cinnamon bun. Okay, just put that
Get
right
in my
there.
Belly.
That's just for Major.
And then I saw the omelet. With all the ingredients, can you just put all of them in one omelet? The kitchen sink omelet, bring that out. Thank you very much.
Including stuff that's not listed. Whatever you have in the kitchen, just throw it in there.
Just make sure it's cooked.
And the sink.
Egg white or regular?
Regular.
Egg
regular.
White.
I
not for this guy.
Egg white stuff, no.
I'm going to get the deluxe breakfasts with bacon and toast, please. It can be wheat toast.
We have wheat.
Wheat.
Thanks. Wheat. Okay, there we go. All the orders are in. Rupert, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
So, John and Julie, John Wood, Julie Myers Wood, are exceptionally attuned guests for this week's conversation about law, terrorism, immigration, everything that's in the heart of the news cycle this week. So let's shift our attention, if we could, in our conversation to the indictments of Paul Manafort and his business associate, Rick Gates, and then someone associated with the Trump campaign named George Papadopoulos. One is a plea agreement in the case of George Papadopoulos. The other is indictments. So I'm just going to let both of you give our audience a general assessment of what you thought was noteworthy about those two legal actions this week, and then we'll dive a little bit more deeply into them both.
Sure. Joe. Well, the Papadopoulos guilty plea really came out of left field. I don't think anybody saw that coming. But first, starting with Manafort, it was certainly not a surprise to anybody that Manafort got indicted. People had been expecting for a long time that he would get charged at least with the charges under FARA, which is the Foreign Agent Registration Act.
That requires you to tell the government that you are lobbying on behalf of a foreign entity.
Exactly. Exactly.
And if you don't, you're technically in violation of the law.
Exactly.
Infrequently prosecuted, but still a problem.
Right. Rarely prosecuted. If it's just the violation of the Foreign Agent Registration Act, then usually it's kind of a technicality. What made this one stand out as being so significant is it appears that allegedly the reason why Manafort didn't register is because he didn't want to have to disclose all the money he was getting that he was then failing to pay taxes on. And so I think two things really stood out on the Manafort indictment. One is that it did not involve any allegations of collusion with the Russian government and the campaign. And so in that sense, it was maybe less newsworthy than what everybody was looking for.
Something the White House tried to point to.
They did. But the other thing that stands out about it that cuts sort of the other way is I was at least surprised at how serious the charges were, because as I was saying, people were expecting him to be charged under the Foreign Agent Registration Act, but the breadth and depth of these charges were really kind of surprising, that he was laundering millions of dollars apparently to avoid paying taxes. And so the takeaway from that is Paul Manafort appears to be in a lot of trouble, which means that Bob Mueller and his team have a lot of leverage over Manafort. And so if Manafort has any information on Trump or the campaign, he's going to be highly incentivized to share it with Mueller.
I want to play what his attorney said after he was in court
Kevin
on Monday.
Downing, yes, the attorney for Paul Manafort.
Katiana, clip number 5.
Today, you see an indictment brought by an Office of Special Counsel that is using a very novel theory to prosecute Mr. Manafort regarding a FARA filing. The United States government has only used that offense 6 times since 1966, and only resulted in one conviction. The second thing about this indictment that I myself find most ridiculous is a claim that maintaining offshore accounts to bring all your funds into the United States as a scheme to conceal from the United States government is ridiculous.
Is it ridiculous?
Yeah, there's nothing novel about this indictment. The government charges people with money laundering and tax evasion crimes all the time. And so there's nothing novel about this. The FARA part of it is somewhat unusual. That's not prosecuted very often, but the money laundering and tax charges are brought all the time.
Do you think do you think the 1 in 5 record on the FARA is relevant in this? I mean, you hear people
one
who
in
are
six.
One out of six, right? Sorry.
Yeah, I think it's irrelevant. I mean, the heart of this case is not about the failure to register. The heart of the case is about the allegations that Manafort and Gates were laundering money through these offshore accounts and not paying taxes on
them. Julie, what jumps out to you?
I think that the detail in the indictment, and that's really a trademark of Andrew Weissman and Mueller, to have very detailed indictments, kind of talking indictments, to try to, you know, make sure that everyone understands it's not just a FARA violation. There's a lot of other activity. There's a lot of other non-transparency money laundering allegations that are very, very serious. I think the other thing that's interesting was the unsealing of the Papadopoulos, information, right on that at that same time. You know, they did that kind of
for a
reason.
Why is that interesting? What does that signal to you, if anything?
I think it signals that they wanted to show right away. They knew, Mueller's team knew that the lawyers would be out saying there's no collusion, this doesn't relate to us at all. And by unsealing, the factual statement and that information, they're saying, wait a minute, we're still on, things are going on, and watch out, frankly, if you've been involved in this.
Do you agree with John that the breadth of this talking indictment on Manafort does possibly incentivize him to be more cooperative with Mueller's investigators?
Only if you have something to say, right? Only if there's information there. If there's no collusion, he has nothing to give up. He has nothing to cooperate about. So certainly, if he has information, relevant information, this indictment's the kind of indictment that can really squeeze him. But if there was nothing there, he's not going to be a cooperator.
To that point, I want to play a soundbite from Trey Gowdy, who is a well-versed member of the House Representatives from South Carolina, Republican, who knows the law pretty well, talks about it with quite an easy facility. And he was on Fox News Sunday a week ago talking about this process of incentivizing or pressurizing a potential witness. That's number three.
One thing I don't get that excited about, although I do see a lot of reporting, is somehow or another you're going to be able to flip a witness and that witness is going to turn state's evidence on everyone else. If you didn't believe a witness yesterday, chances are great you're not going to believe that witness tomorrow.
John, is that true? Is that a truism in the law and from a prosecutor's point of view?
Well,
that pressurizing someone doesn't make them necessarily more credible than they were before the pressure was applied.
No, that's absolutely right. And, I think a prosecutor has to be very careful not to be pressuring somebody into saying things that aren't true simply in order to get credit for cooperation. But the point of the pressure is it could get Manafort or Gates or others to share information that they otherwise might be very reluctant to share, because without these charges, they don't have that much incentive to turn on Trump or anybody on the campaign if they have anything to say about them. And again, as Julie said, maybe Manafort doesn't have anything to share, in which case he's just in trouble and he can't get himself out of it. But if he's got relevant information to share, he can probably cut a deal where his sentence will be reduced in exchange for giving the information.
But certainly, if Manafort does start cooperating and shares information, if any cases go to trial based on information that Manafort's provided, you can bet that defense counsel will be up there during summation saying, hey, don't believe this guy. He only talked when the pressure was on him because he spent, $900,000 on coats.
Right. But the information that he gives could be relevant just as testimonial evidence, in which case his credibility is at stake. But it also could just be giving Mueller some leads that Mueller can then use to chase down other things.
That's right. And his team is very, very experienced in using cooperators, both Andrew Weissman, Greg Andrus, the whole Mueller team, many of whom I worked with in the Eastern District, spent a lot of time flipping.
You know some of these people.
That's right. Andrew Weissman was my boss. Mm-hmm. Greg Andrus was down the hall from me in the Eastern District of New York. Top prosecutors, really smart guys. If there's something going on, this team's going to find it.
Real quick, where are we after seeing this come out on Monday, where are we at the point at the point in this investigation?
That's a real simple question.
The beginning.
I think that's important to say.
We're close to the beginning. One of our former colleagues who worked with us in the justice or worked with us in the government, I think, very aptly described it as we're really at the bottom of the second inning in a long game here. So I think there's a long way to go.
So you're both doubtful of the White House expressions made through John Kelly, the chief of staff, and others that we're near the end of this.
No, we're not near the end of this. I'd be very shocked if we're anywhere close to the end of this.
Julie, you agree?
Absolutely. I think, unfortunately, it's just begun.
That's the voice of John Wood and his wife, Julie Myers Wood, deeply experienced in federal prosecutions and federal government from the law perspective and in the private sector. You're listening to The Takeout and enjoying every single minute of it.
You're listening to The Takeout.
It's a digital television show. It's a podcast. It's a radio show. Takeout is all-inclusive, isn't it, Steve Shigaris?
All-inclusive.
All-inclusive. I'm Major Garrett. That's Steve Shigaris, the world's
greatest. Wait for the movie.
Exactly. World's greatest podcast sidekick. We're at Cafe Deluxe for breakfast this episode of The Takeout. Every episode is built around a meal. We love to do that because it enhances the conversation and it fills me up. Steve, tell our audience what these are. And how they get them.
So our regular viewers and listeners know what these are. These
yes.
are
those who are brand new to The Takeout may not be familiar.
We offer an item.
One piece of swag for listeners for the show. One piece of swag and one piece of swag only.
It's a sticker.
Yes.
It's a sticker of our logo that is signed
by me.
Major Garrett.
That's right.
Major E. Garrett.
Exactly.
There's only one way to get
only one way.
This sticker.
What is it? What is it? What is that way?
Everybody
America
knows
is waiting.
But if you would like your very own Takeout podcast sticker signed by Major, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to...
Self-addressed stamped envelope is the only way.
Takeout sticker, care of CBS News, 2020 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20036.
John and Julie, John Wood and his wife, Julie Myers Wood, are our guests for the Takeout episode this week. They are deeply experienced in law and the federal government's orientation to the law and in the private sector. They are perfect guests to unpack a very busy news week in terms of the terrorism attack in New York and the indictments related to those associated with the Trump campaign. Before we get to that, because you and our audience who are brand new may not be really sure how many people have actually mailed us letters.
Hundreds.
For those Takeout podcast
stickers.
We've hit
the number 350.
350. 350 letters, John and Julie.
Pretty good.
Nice.
Not bad. Because you can't send us an email. We don't accept a tweet or a Facebook post. You have to do it old school. 70s retro style self-addressed stamped envelope. More than 350 letters.
And some people write letters, really nice letters.
They do.
And
we love
thoughtful
them.
Letters. I want to read one from Mark and Janet of Lake Oswego, Oregon. Oregon in the top five, by the way, number of requests of the states. Top five from Oregon.
Oregon.
Lovely.
Punching way above its weight.
Dear Major Garrett, we've watched you throughout the presidential campaign to present day, and we are big fans. Please write a book one day to reveal all that you've seen and learned about true politics around you. That's such a great idea. A
wow.
book.
Wow.
Have you thought about, have you thought about that?
I actually have thought about that.
Oh, really?
And coincidentally, as things happen, there was a press release to that effect this week from my publisher,
really?
St. Martin's in New York. Yes, I've signed a contract to write, yes, indeed, a book on the first year of the Trump presidency, starting on election night 2017 and going through November 8th, 2017. It'll be out in the fall of 2018 if, in fact, I'm able to find time to write it, which I will very much try to do.
Major. I've held this letter.
Fantastic.
I've held this letter for 2 months waiting for the moment to get you an actual book.
For the final
anyway,
book. Yes, exactly.
Buy the book.
Mr. Trump's Wild Ride is what the book will be called, with a very long subtitle we won't bore you with now. Back to the topic at hand, or the many topics at hand. So, John Wood, Julie Myers Wood, the George Papadopoulos plea agreement. That's different than an indictment. And one of you, tell our audience what the key difference is, because it may sound obvious, but we like at this show to bring clarity to things that even in Washington we assume are obvious, because they aren't always.
Sure. Well, the difference between an indictment and a plea agreement is that an indictment is a charging document. So the indictment of Manafort and Gates doesn't mean they're guilty. It just means that the government has brought charges. It just tells one side of the story. We really, aside from some comments made by Manafort's lawyer, we really haven't heard Manafort or Gates' side of the story. Plea agreement's very different. That means that not only has the person been charged, but the person admits to having committed the crime. And what's particularly noteworthy about the Papadopoulos plea agreement is that he's agreed to cooperate and appears to have been cooperating for the past several weeks, because this plea agreement was entered a few weeks ago and kept under seal.
Julie, what strikes you about that particular plea agreement and what it might portend?
It pretends that they're going to, that Mueller's group is going to use kind of every tool at their disposal, and they, you know, they want to get people to cooperate and to provide information on others who are out there, and they're going to do it in ways that are not always transparent. And so, people who may be a subject of this investigation or a witness, if they're talking to others, they should think about, you know, if they're talking to someone, is that person cooperating? And I think we can see that, you know, they are really going to be aggressive on this.
I want to ask both of you, is collusion a term of art under the law?
No. So collusion by itself is not a crime. Conspiracy okay. can be, but it has to be conspiracy to do something illegal.
Right. But collusion keeps getting thrown around. There isn't. But it is it a legally relevant concept as we watch this process unfold?
Well, collusion by itself is not legally determinative. It doesn't mean that there was a crime committed if there's collusion, but it's kind of a shorthand for collusion to do something. So, for example, and purely a hypothetical, I'm not at all suggesting that the investigation is going to go this way, but if they found that there was collusion between the Trump campaign and Russians to hack into
breakfast has arrived.
Servers or something like that.
We're not kidding about that.
That would certainly be a crime.
Right. So. Okay. So collusion itself is topical, but until something does or doesn't happen under its umbrella, not relevant until we see what the underlying allegations might or might not be. Is that right, Julie? Am I understanding that correctly?
That's exactly right. And they're using the term collusion to make it more kind of understandable, kind of not to get into legalese. And I'm sure if there ever is a kind of a trial, they'll be talking about collusion, even though it's not specifically part of a charging document.
Now, an attorney for Sam Clovis, who was the co-chairman of the Trump campaign, has, through this attorney, denied some of the representations made by George Papadopoulos in this plea agreement, specifically that this person, Sam Clovis, on behalf of the Trump campaign, encouraged him to pursue not just travel, but other means by which to engage and learn from Russian operatives, possibly officials, with potentially damaging information on Hillary Clinton. One thing that struck me, and I've read a lot of plea agreements, but I had to be reminded by reading the last paragraph of the plea agreement. It says the person who signs it is understanding that if anything subsequently is proven to be false, they are subject to a federal perjury prosecution. So help our audience understand the relative weight of that assertion and the threat of potential perjury prosecution up against an attorney for someone else saying, well, it's not true.
Well, you know, Papadopoulos would face a lot of legal jeopardy if he were to agree to anything in the statements that was false. So he's highly incentivized to tell the truth and to be very careful in doing it. So,
and an attorney for someone named in that would be doing their job by saying, well, it's not true. And until you can prove it otherwise, we're going to say it's not true.
That's right. And that always happens. And so you always see, if there is a high profile, indictment or plea agreement and there's someone else that's named, that, the lawyers are always coming out in the beginning and saying, it's not true. They're never saying, oh, yes, you're right. You got me. I'm surrendering tomorrow. So, I think that's right now, I think it's just lawyer speak.
Okay. Steve?
So you mentioned earlier we are at the beginning of this investigation still. The president keeps saying Trump is not being investigated. Trump is not part of any of this. What is your take on that? At some point you think he's going to get roped into this? You think he's going to be dragged in to talk to Mueller about what's been going on? What is your sense on where Trump is going to be his involvement in this investigation?
I think Mueller's team will be judicious in asking to speak with the president, but I think if the evidence leads there, there's precedent for doing it before, with President Clinton and other things, so I'm sure they will do that if they think they need to get there. And I think right now, this is just the very beginning strike, and so I don't think we can fully tell kind of how high up it will lead or who will be key witnesses for some of these prosecutions.
So it's sort of just sort of a hollow thing that he's saying in that I'm not being investigated right now, but eventually, at some point, you think there's a chance that
it
he will...
It may be hollow. We don't know.
Right.
We don't know if he's being investigated. I mean, Mueller's running a pretty tight ship. Mm-hmm. There have not been very many leaks. We don't know exactly what he's focusing on. As I said earlier, the Papadopoulos plea agreement really came out of left field. So we don't know what Mueller's doing. We don't know whether he's investigating the president or not. But in terms of whether the president ultimately will have to testify, my guess would be that he will end up testifying in some form. Doesn't mean that he's being investigated himself, but I would think that at the very least he's probably going to end up being a witness to something that will be of interest regarding the campaign.
That's the voice of John Wood. His wife, Julie Myers Wood, is with us. They are both exceptionally qualified to talk about the news of the week because they are experienced lawyers. Work for the federal government and in the private sector. I'm Major Garrett with Steve Shigaris. You are listening to and most thoroughly enjoying The Takeout.
You're listening to The Takeout.
And enjoying every moment of it, I'm Major Garrett, joined as I am every episode by Steve Shigaris. Hello, Steve.
Hello.
Breakfast time here at Cafe Deluxe, downtown Washington, D.C. You know, we started this as a podcast, then it became a Webby TV show on CBSN. Hello, CBSN. And now it's a radio show all over our great country. But for those who started with us in podcast land, just remember, new episodes of The Takeout, this very great podcast, are available every Friday morning. We most earnestly invite you to subscribe, rate, and comment on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Go to takeoutpodcast.com. You know you can follow us and like us. I mean, you can really like us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. And here's the sort of therapy side of my pitch. Hate the show, love the show. Do you just need to vent about some topic that's on your mind? We do understand. You can do that at Takeout Podcast at CBSNews.com. Did you get all that, Steve?
I've got it all written down.
Okay, good.
Actually, I got it all up here.
Okay, excellent. Our guests are John Wood and his wife, Julie Myers Wood. They're not here just because they're a wonderful, winning, fetching couple here in Washington, D.C.
Or just for the free food.
Or just for the free food, although that is a benefit. Yeah. That is a fringe benefit, no doubt. Breakfasted here at Cafe Deluxe, but to talk to us about lots of issues relevant to the news this week. I want to talk to you, Julie, because of your experience in immigration, customs, and enforcement about an issue the president brought up right after the terrorist attack in New York about the diversity lottery program within the 1990 Immigration Act. Talk to us about what that program does and address, if you'd be so kind, the president's assertion that it is problematic in relation to combating terrorism.
Sure. So the program is designed to ensure that the U.S. is admitting individuals from countries that had been underrepresented. And so it actually started out in part because of underrepresentation in Europe, Ireland, anyone. And so, you know, it's really focused on underrepresented countries and trying to ensure that there is some influx into the U.S. from those countries. Over the years, the program has been highly criticized as being subject to fraud and problematic in various elements.
And when the president talks about chain migration, help our audience understand, because they're going to hear that phrase a lot, I suspect. What does that mean?
It means for individuals that have come over, they're able to bring at some point their, you know, their family members over. And the focus is to move from kind of chain migration to merit-based migration. And so most other countries, like Canada, all around the world, look to see for immigration, what does our labor market need? Do we need low-skill workers? Do we need high-skill workers? Our country mostly doesn't do that. We have some immigration programs that are based on the needs of the workforce, but many of our immigration programs are based on family immigration or the diversity visa lottery, which is kind of just winning, you know, winning a lucky ticket. There are some minimum requirements. You have to have some minimum education, but it's not necessarily the experience or jobs that the U.S. needs to fill.
But the president is taking a program that is politically controversial, that has been accused of being a haven for fraud, and tying it to terrorism. Is there a tie there? Do we know anything? Is there a history of terrorism or people that become terrorists getting through to this country in this program?
You know, unfortunately, there are a couple of individuals in the past that have come in on this program that engaged in terrorist activities. Others have engaged in other criminal activities. But you can't say that this program is any worse than any of the other kind of immigration programs. And what's unfortunate is when something happens, when something serious happens, a terrorist event happens, if someone was not born in this country, they're then looking at how did they get here and what did we do and did we do enough screening at the time. In this case, it's not clear that there were any issues with the screening. It looks like potentially he became radicalized kind of while he was in the United States. So the screening here may have been fine. Now, overall, our screening back in 2010 when he came into the U.S. was not up to par. And that's not just for the diversity program. It's for immigration visa programs across the board. We were not checking social media. We did not have kind of the enhanced screening that they're putting in place now after San Bernardino.
Can I just switch subjects real quick since you were the head of ICE at one point? What is your take on the president's insistence on getting a border wall?
On the border wall?
Yeah.
That is not a
topic. Out of left field. Out of left field.
That's pretty heavy for breakfast. Well, I think, there are a lot of Americans who are very, very frustrated about the state of border security these days. And they feel that we are not doing enough. And frankly, there are some places in the country on our southern border where a physical deterrence have made a great deal of difference. There are other places where a wall is not an effective.
My hometown of San Diego is a classic example of that.
That's right. But of course, what did
San Diego,
they do?
They built a more reinforced fence than they had before. And it made a difference.
That's right. But what did it do with the illegal migration? It pushed it.
Pushed it.
Mm-hmm. It pushed it. And so you really need to have, I think, a layered approach that looks at both physical barriers, you know, how we're staffing, all these things. But, you know, you can't just increase the Border Patrol year after year. We've got to think about other ways to have a more effective immigration system. From my perspective, that really includes kind of broader immigration reform, which, frankly, does say we should look at the diversity visa program and figure out if is that what we need to make the America of the next century. I think that certainly physical solutions like the wall can only be part of it. And in fact, you know, 30 to 40% of individuals who are in this country illegally did not come across the southern or the northern border without authorization. They came in with a visa, and then they overstayed the visa, and they didn't check out, and we did nothing kind of to find those individuals. So you really got to have kind of a layered approach that looks at kind of the labor demand and looks at enforcement and takes a lot of things into account.
Julie, you mentioned a moment earlier, and I wanted to kind of help our audience get more of your sense of this, that you know some of the people who are participating with Robert Mueller's investigation, the special counsel. Now, I've talked to people who are very close to the President of the United States, not in the White House, but on the outside. They say, they look at that lineup and say they're killers. These guys and gals are incredibly good, and they're nervous about what that might mean for the president. And they're like, he needs to staff up with more lawyers. He needs to have more some killers on his side of the ledger. I know you can't really deal with that. But give our audience a sense of the skill set that Robert Mueller has assembled.
Well, he is, Mueller is unparalleled in terms of his expertise and knowledge, both on the prosecutorial side and also from being the FBI director. And he has built an all-star team, but it is a very aggressive team. And so I think one of the trademarks of Andrew Weissman and Greg Andres and some of the others is that they build very tough cases, very detailed cases, and they keep pushing and pushing until they get where the investigation leads.
John, you've built cases like that. You've tried to as U.S. attorney from the Western District of Missouri. What's your sense of that team and how nervous or possibly not nervous the White House ought to be?
I think the White House should be nervous. I agree with Julie that it's an all-star team. These are people who have given up other very plum positions, whether in some cases it's other government positions and the case of some other people, very lucrative private practices to go in and do this. And so I don't think that the people on Mueller's team would be giving up the kinds of positions they had unless they really believed that this investigation was going to go on for some time and to, you know, really lead somewhere. So to answer your question, I think people at the White House ought to be nervous.
This has been a heavy news week for all of us in the country. And for our audience here at The Takeout, we wanted to bring two great voices, not just to issues of immigration, terrorism, the developments related to the indictments and the plea agreements. What we try to do is help people take the important and separate it from the maybe slightly trivial or hyped. We've tried to do that. John and Julie, you've been exceptional. We thank you for joining us here at The Takeout. I'm Major Garrett with Steve Shigaris. We'll see you next week.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Fari and Katiana Krachenko. CBSN production by Alex Zuckerman and Eric Susanen. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. And for more, visit takeoutpodcast.com. The Takeout is a production of CBS News Radio.
Who likes this? Well, you have no weight problems. That's the good news, right? Good. So you take out whatever you need, okay? If you want some for your friends, take them. We have plenty.